It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. With its disruption to the economy and our food supply, the coronavirus pandemic spurred greater interest in backyard chickens across Wisconsin. More and more communities are passing laws to allow them. So we're getting tips on how to get started. You've got to keep them safe from predators, make sure they've got good shelter, fresh food and water, especially in the freezing winter days. And will you keep them after their egg laying slows down? Here with us is Nick Lewandowski, owner of Sunnyside Hatchery in Beaver Dam. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. Have you ever wanted to try raising backyard chickens? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Nick, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me, Molly.
So, demand has spiked during the pandemic. What have you seen in it at your hatchery?
Well, we saw unprecedented demand, especially starting the spring of 2020. Obviously, we had no way of preparing in the fall before that and the winter before that, when we have to plan for our breeding numbers and contracting hatching eggs and stuff like that. So 2020 flew by. We just barely were able to meet demand. Definitely stretched us out further into the hatching season with higher demand than we'd ever experienced. And then as we started the 2021 season this spring, we saw a lot of folks that maybe missed the bus in 2020 and got in early. And a lot of returning customers, and it's slowed down significantly since then, but I would still say it was a pretty darn good year.
And why do you think so many folks are interested in raising chickens these days?
Well, I think on your intro, you touched on it a little bit. There was some uncertainty, especially last year in the early days of the pandemic, when eggs were driven up to $4 or $5 a dozen. And then all the rumors of chicken shortages and grocery shelves being out of chicken meat, it was a perfect recipe for people that all of a sudden had a bunch of time on their hands. Maybe they'd entertained the thought of getting into backyard birds or hobby birds in the past, and with the extra time, in a lot of cases with kids staying home from school, and a longer summer than they anticipated. I think it was just a perfect recipe for things to really take off.
Yeah. And what breeds have been most popular at your hatchery?
Well, there's always the old standby. We've got what's called a Cornish Rock. It's an old cross that's been used for many, many years, probably since about the early 50s, 60s. It's a fast-growing meat chicken. It takes only about 8 weeks, even in a backyard scenario, to get that bird from a day old to into the freezer. And they're very efficient converters of feed. And if you can keep them alive in the first few days when they're the most vulnerable, mm-hmm. and then keep them alive in the last few days when they're just growing so quickly, when they're getting ready to be processed. They do really well for people, and they can fill up your freezers pretty quickly. We also have commercial type egg producer production bird. It's a cross between a Rhode Island Red and a White Leghorn many generations ago, and it's been perfected over time. And they're just a very dependable layer. They'll convert feed into about an 80% lay rate over the course of their productive lives in the first couple years. And then we also have some more traditional type breeds, heritage type breeds, that classify as dual purpose. So the males can be used as for meat birds a little bit later than a Cornish Rock, obviously. And then the females can be kept for their egg production. And they provide a good, both options for people that are looking to fill up the freezer and to get eggs on a regular basis. So we've got a number of birds, and then I'm happy to announce in 2022 we're actually going to expand our birds, our heritage type birds, and we're going to get into some bantams as well. I really wanted to expand into some areas where like 4-H kids could get some birds in the springtime and raise them as 4-H projects. And we'll have more opportunities to do that with some other purebred lines.
So what are the things that, you know, if somebody is approaching this for the first time and maybe they're looking at the catalog and they're seeing all these different types of breeds, how do you counsel them to pick one that would do well? What are some of the things? I imagine winter hardiness is a big factor. You mentioned mm-hmm. the productivity. How many eggs are they going to lay? Or what are some of the other things people should be thinking about?
Well, I think the main thing, just like when people are considering getting a pet or getting some, you know, livestock into their hobby farm, they've got to definitely consider the time commitment. I mean, you might not want to admit it, you're becoming a farmer, and you're responsible for the care of these animals, you know, from the day they arrive to the day they end up in your freezer or they go down the road. And so make sure that you're up for the process here. And for people that are buying laying chickens, I mean, it's a 5 or 6 month commitment to get those birds from being a baby chick all the time up to the point when they're ready to lay eggs. So that's the first thing I want people to kind of take a step back and consider.
Not immediate gratification.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to take time. I mean, it's going to take at least a couple months to get you meat. It's going to take you 5 or 6 months to get those first eggs if you're getting day old poultry. So that's the main thing there. And then also, you know, if you anticipate you're going to be using these birds for meat or for egg production, how many eggs can you handle? Do you is it just your family you're going to be feeding? Are you going to be supplying a farmer's market or selling to your neighbors? There's a good match out there for everybody. And if anybody ever has any questions, they're more than welcome to shoot me an email or give a call here. But and we also offer assortments too. So, you know, first timers, and we understand that, you know, the folks that are getting involved with urban poultry really don't have a rooster option,
right?
But we can get a nice assortment of different types of birds, especially for those first timers to find out which personalities, which production capabilities, what colors, do people prefer, you know, for that second and, subsequent batches.
Well, and you raise a really good point about roosters versus hens. And talk us through how you're able to tell the difference so that people know what they're getting.
Okay, so there are several ways of getting, of sexing day-old poultry. The oldest method is it takes a very trained eye. I don't know how to do it. Very few people do. It's called vent sexing, where they actually look on the chicken's backside, and with a very keen eye can be trained to tell the difference between what a male's parts look like and what a female's parts look like. That is a trade that very few people get into. So we have avoided that. We've taken a simpler but a little bit more costly up front. We actually have our breeding stock is pedigreed. We know what the male lines will produce. We know what the females will produce. So when the males are bred to the females, the females will be fast feathering once they're out of the egg. The males will be slow feathering. So the way we sex our chicks out here at the hatchery, all the breeds that we handle, is we're able to just spread their wings open right after they dry out. And we can tell by the feather development in the wing if they're male or female. So,
like
I said, you can't just take two of your backyard birds and get that quality that needs to be bred into it several generations before. And you need to know, the male line and the female line in order to get that. But it really makes things simple. It's easier to train people to do that. We do claim about a 90% accuracy, but certainly when it comes to providing those birds to our customers, we're able to deliver those at a more competitive cost by using this method.
So people really know what they're getting as opposed to, you know, leaving it up to chance of natural selection. They can order hens specifically if they are looking for a backyard and they're living in a city where you can't have a rooster.
That's true. We do have those options.
We're speaking with Nick Lewandowski, owner of Sunnyside Hatchery, which has been providing chickens for over 100 years now. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stenz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. We're talking about how to raise chickens in your backyard. So there's the reliable old Rhode Island Red, the gorgeous silver-laced Wyandottes, the classic Dominique, of course the Easter Eggers. Or do you go for the fancy Faverolles or the Polish chickens with their wild hairdos? What's your favorite breed? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking to Nick Lewandowski from the Sunnyside Hatchery in Beaver Dam. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. Well, Nick, there are so many questions for you. I have one from Tom who came in over email, sent us an email, and says that he's got 7 of his 8 chickens with bare bottoms. He doesn't see any lice or mites, and he's looking for some help or advice. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I guess I'd like to know how old these birds are. Are they just day-old birds? You know, sometimes boredom will cause chicks to, you know, especially pick in on the backsides. They might pull some feathers or pull some down early on. Maybe take a look, make sure the feed that it's being provided to them is appropriate for their type and their stage of life. You know, there was an old saying that I used to have in my former job was when, you know, if a bird isn't getting what it needs in its feed, it'll find it off its neighbor's backs. So, definitely make sure that they're getting what they need, you know, the appropriate type and amount of feed. And I wouldn't be too worried as long as they're not drawing blood. I mean, once you start drawing blood, those chickens, however old they are, will grow accustomed to, you know, to getting that blood and becoming cannibalistic. So we want to stay away from that. But I think as long as we're not dealing with that issue right now, find the right feed and hopefully, you know, with the temperatures starting to cool, that feather growth will start to pick up a little bit as it gets a little cooler.
Sure. And so when folks are ordering chickens from you, are you sending them as day-old chicks or do you sell older pullets as well?
Actually, we just got done this last week doing ready-to-lay pullets. We sold 18-week-old birds just starting to lay. So we offer those flocks for sale. You know, we had customers that were getting as few as 2 or 3, as many as 100. We offer those in July, August, and then around Labor Day as well. Aside from that, everything else is day-old poultry. Once in a while we work, not only do we have people come to the hatchery to pick up, but we also mail out. Now we're only able to mail birds that are day old. And then we also, run, different routes throughout the state into Minnesota, into Iowa, even into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, during the spring and summer. And we can hold some birds over the weekend, put them on feed. And if the customers are okay, we can give them, you know, birds that are 3 or 4 days started even in some instances, but that season's beyond, you know, we're only just dealing with pickups and mail order right now.
Sure.
So, but majority we do is day old, but we also offer, ready to lay pullets a couple times a year.
And what do you recommend for feed?
You know, I think your best, you know, for the listeners out there, some of their best resources oftentimes right in their hometowns. Almost every village and city across the state has a hometown feed mill. We work with a lot of these people as our partners in distribution, and the knowledge that they bring, and they're always very willing to work with people. And most of the time, they carry all the appropriate types of feed. You know, you've got meat-producing feed, you've got laying-producing feed, and you also have feed for different stages. You know, day-old started, you know, a few weeks down the line, you'd give them a grower, and if they're a meat bird, you give them a finisher. But, you know, most hometown feed mills carry these types of all these types of feeds, and their feed managers would be more than willing to work with you.
And they have different amounts of protein.
A lot of earlier in life, you want to give them a lot of protein because those birds are concentrating more on growing, obviously, than you know, producing an egg. So you got to get them mature. So high protein up front, and as they grow older, whether we're talking meat birds or laying hens, you want to step that down. But pretty much every stage of life, you know, there's a feed out there. All the major feed manufacturers have, you know, multiple stages of feed that they have on offer. And get out to your local feed dealer. Great resources, and it's just a great way to support your local economy.
And what about winter? What provisions do you find that chickens really need to get through some of those really harsh winter days?
Right. Well, you know, the most important thing is to provide them the shelter. They're actually, most birds are very, like, cold tolerant. As long as you could, you know, keep them out of the wind, they certainly do appreciate a little supplemental heat. Definitely, you know, you want to make sure that their water isn't freezing up, and their feed consumption will also go up in the winter. So you got to make sure you're feeding them plenty of feed, because you know, they'll produce their own heat by that by eating more and digesting more. But you know, I would just make sure that wherever you're keeping them, and during a Wisconsin winter, you don't give them too much space, because they do kind of lean on their neighbor's body heat to stay warm. Straw bales make a good insulation. But yeah, keep it a little tighter in the winter, just so they can use that body heat. But, you know, if you keep it a smaller area, you also want to make sure you're keeping it clean, though, too, because without that extra ventilation and fewer birds per square, you know, footage, you might have a little ammonia buildup in the winter. That becomes a problem, too. So keep it cleaner. Keep it, you know, nice and tight and locked up. Keep that water from freezing up, and your birds should flourish in the winter and be ready to hit the ground running come springtime.
Well, and Nick, we've got another caller on the line for you. We'll go next to Bayfield County, where Steve is joining us this morning. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, good morning. So we've talked about the glamorous part of chicken. I think it's time to get into the little bit darker, nastier part of chicken. Chickens are fun. I've got 20, 25, I don't even know how many laying hens I have. I'm getting about a dozen eggs a day. My roosters, I have a few roosters. I've got ducks. They're a lot of fun, don't get me wrong. But in my opinion, chickens are the most destructive animal on the planet. Not to mention something that a lot of people don't realize. A chicken will poo roughly once every 6 to 10 minutes. On top of that, chickens are extremely smelly. And you have to be very vigilant on keeping their area clean and taking care of everything else, because especially if you free-range your birds, you better not have a problem with there being a mess on just about everything you own.
Good not point.
I want to get into eggs real quick.
Thanks. We're up against the clock, and I want to just hear from Nick on that, on making sure that you're able to deal with the waste.
Yeah, Steve brings up a great point. They do, as much as you're putting in into those birds, they're expelling it out. So you need to give them plenty of space. They do make a great fertilizer, naturally fertilizing the lawn as they get out and forage around. But if you keep them in a pretty tight confines, you know, they're going to root up a lot of the grass in that small area. And it can get dirty really quickly. So it's important to, You know, that's why people are using chicken tractors a lot, so they're not being too destructive on the ground. You know, they're picking through the weed seeds, eating the bugs, but they're also fertilizing it.
Portable,
and then you move them over to the next
portable
next
coops that you can move
around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that helps out with you know, the birds tearing up the lawn too much, because yeah, Steve brings up a good point. They are they produce a lot of waste, and you can benefit with that waste if you're managing them correctly, but it doesn't take very long for it to get unsightly if, you know, if you're just keeping them in one spot. So the lawn will get a little tore up, and the birds will look a little rough too. So you've got to, whether you're keeping them in three or four in the backyard in the city, or you've got a couple hundred in the country, yeah, keeping them moving is important.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, no problem, Molly. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Nick Lewandowski, the owner of Sunnyside Hatchery. They've been providing chickens for more than 100 years. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. Up next is news. Then we take a look at the ever-expanding market of dollar stores and the role they play in everyday shopping. I'm Molly Stentz. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. More and more Americans are shopping at dollar stores for basic needs. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the explosive rise of stores like Dollar General and Dollar Tree. Analysts at CoreSite Research say dollar stores are expected to open more than 1,600 locations this year, representing nearly half of all national retail openings, half of all new retail stores. What brings you to the dollar store? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Abba Badarai is a national retail reporter for the Washington Post, and she joins us this morning. Welcome, Abba.
Thank you.
Well, you've looked at why the business of dollar stores is booming. Why is this happening now?
Well, we're in month 18 of the pandemic, which has been a very financially tough time for many people, and prices are beginning to rise across the board. You know, you might have noticed at the local supermarket that just things like meat and paper towels are costing more than they did a year ago. And so many people are saying that they simply can't afford to shop at the supermarket anymore. They're going to the dollar store instead, where they can kind of stretch their money a bit more.
So what does it say about our economy these days that these stores are doing so well?
You know, it speaks to the growing inequality we're seeing across the economy. And as one analyst I talked to put it, there's now dollar store land and there's Whole Foods land. We've seen a sort of a hollowing out of the middle class, which means people are flocking to one end or the other. You know, either they're splurging on groceries because they have a little bit of extra income, they're saving on things like travel, or they're really having to hunker down and stretch every dollar as best they can.
Right. So you mentioned this Whole Foods America versus dollar store America. Where are we seeing dollar stores expand?
You know, honestly, everywhere. Traditionally, they've been in rural areas or more impoverished neighborhoods where they're often the only grocery store or the only big box store in town. Now we're starting to see them proliferate just about anywhere. There's going to be 1,600, like you said, new dollar store openings this year. And what's staggering is just the sheer number of dollar stores we already have in this country. There are more than 34,000 of them, which is more than every single Walmart, Starbucks, and McDonald's combined.
And so I have to ask, how are dollar stores able to sell products for just a dollar?
Well, that's a great question. You know, Dollar General in particular, which is the largest chain, has huge buying power. It is a very large chain, and it's able to just buy up huge quantities and keep prices low that way. The other side of that is that dollar stores don't typically have a lot of fresh produce or meat or things like that that have very low profit margins, you know, that tend to be perishable and tend to really cut into a company's profits. And so they sell things that are with huge margins, honestly. I mean, things like canned foods and plastic products, paper products, those are generally more profitable than fresh produce. And so that's how they're able to sort of pad their profits and also keep prices low.
So they can buy in bulk and leverage this huge economy of scale, and they can buy products that aren't perishable, so they can keep them around and keep them on shelves, and also make a little bit more money than things that might, you might have to move through more quickly, as you mentioned.
Exactly. And they also have smaller stores generally than like a sprawling grocery store that you might see. So they have lower rents. They're in lower price parts of town where, rents are more affordable. And they're also known for keeping their stores very thinly staffed. So there might just be one or two employees at a time versus maybe dozens at a grocery store. So they're able to save on costs there too.
Mm-hmm. So Dollar Tree announced last week, I saw, that it's planning to cut its full year profit forecast due to rising freight costs. What kind of supply chain issues have they been experiencing?
Dollar stores have been facing the same supply chain crunches as everybody else. There's shipping delays, there's manufacturing delays, factories are short-staffed. Even once things make it over the ocean, the ports in the United States are completely clogged, and so there's huge delays and shortages. But Dollar Tree is in a unique position. It's one of the only large chain that continues to sell everything for a dollar. So as their prices go up, their profits go down because the price is set. And, they can make up for that in some ways by shrinking package sizes and things like that. But those generally take a longer time to normalize. And so they're really feeling the brunt of it right now.
Right. Because as you mentioned, we're talking about dollar stores, but that doesn't actually mean everything's a dollar in some of these dollar stores.
Exactly. At most dollar stores, you can end up spending $10 or $20 on a product. And so they are discount stores, but not necessarily everything for a dollar.
And so what impact are they having on the grocery landscape? What do we know about this?
So critics generally say that dollar stores help put local grocers out of business. Like I said, they have all of these different ways to keep prices low, and local grocery stores just cannot compete in many cases. They also tend to sell things in smaller quantities. So even though the unit price might be a bit higher at a dollar store than it is at, say, Walmart, when you only have $5, you're going to buy the smaller package, even if it ends up being a little bit more expensive. So a number of things. But, we're starting to see cities crack down on this proliferation of dollar stores. They're starting to say, we don't want a dollar store on every corner. And certain cities are saying you can't open a new one within a mile or two of an existing dollar store, for example, or they're requiring that they have a pharmacy or sell fresh groceries as a way to sort of get more fresh food options into the community.
Right, because you quote somebody in your article that says dollar stores are the number one driver of food deserts.
Exactly. So the idea there is that these dollar stores are putting out grocery stores and other local businesses out of business, but they're just not filling that gap. They're not providing enough fresh fruit and vegetables. So you end up just having to rely on frozen foods or canned foods, shelf-stable foods, and when that's sort of everything you're eating that week, it becomes a problem.
So do we see that happening in communities where they're actually... I mean, folks need fresh food, vegetables, and dairy milk, the perishable things that you mentioned that, have a lower margin on them and are pretty perishable. Are they really able to put grocery stores out of business that are able to offer more things than dollar stores do?
Absolutely. We've seen this dynamic happen over and over. A dollar store moves into town, it undercuts the grocery store on certain items, and when you're strapped for cash, that's where you end up going. We are starting to see that change in some parts of the country. Oklahoma City, for example, has been very good about placing limits on what dollar stores can come in and really trying to offer incentives on for dollar stores to expand into fresh food and grocery, but it's still been very difficult.
We're speaking with Abba Badarai. She is a national retail reporter for The Washington Post. So, Abba, you've discovered that Amazon is planning to open brick-and-mortar retail stores. They're expected to be these large 30,000-square-foot stores. what impact is that going to have on the landscape of dollar stores?
You know, that's a great question. And it kind of speaks to this broader theme that we're seeing throughout the economy and in retail as well, where the biggest, most powerful companies, the wealthiest companies, are getting wealthier. And the smaller ones are just kind of falling by the wayside. They're really struggling. And Amazon, Walmart, Target, Dollar General, all of these companies have thrived during the pandemic. And that makes it that much harder for their other counterparts to compete.
And so you mentioned that the communities are starting to regulate or trying to restrict them. How does that work? Is that through zoning? What options are cities using?
There are a number of different ways, but what we typically see is that they pass local legislation or they have a, you know, temporary moratorium on the opening of new stores within a mile or two, say, within a certain area of an existing store, or they have different requirements for a new store that comes in. And so, you know, if the store doesn't have a pharmacy or isn't selling at least, say, 500 square feet worth of fresh food, then they're just not allowed to open.
We're speaking with Abba Badarai. She is a retail reporter for The Washington Post this morning. You can join us here at The Ideas Network, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the explosive growth of dollar stores across America. It's The Morning Show on The Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. The market and consumer data website Statista says that we have more than 34,000 dollar stores across the country. For some perspective, that number is more than every Walmart, Starbucks, and McDonald's combined. I read that in the Washington Post. How do you feel about the growth of dollar stores? We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. And we're speaking to Washington Post reporter Abba Badarai this morning. So I'm wondering where did the stores come from? What's the origin story of some of these dollar stores and how they were able to achieve such market dominance so quickly?
You know, that's a great question. I think people have always been drawn to discounts, and that's particularly the case during recessions and other periods of economic turmoil. So we've really seen a speed up of these stores in the last, you know, during the last recession and now during the pandemic, when so many people are strapped for cash and just having to trade down in many cases from their local supermarket to the dollar store.
Yeah. And so is there any one store that is kind of doing the best right now?
Dollar General is sort of the king of this space. They're the largest, so they have the most buying power, they have the most locations, and they also have been just very successful during the pandemic. Foot traffic is up 32% at Dollar General stores, which is compared to 3% at Walmart from pre-pandemic figures. And so there's been a huge surge at Dollar General in particular.
And so how's Walmart responding? I mean, because the economic situation you're describing reminds me of the effect we saw Walmart having on small retailers, neighborhood grocers, the, you know, bringing several stores into the market, perhaps crowding out local retailers. What do they feel threatened by dollar stores?
That's a great question. You know, we're seeing retailers of all kinds, including Walmart, experiment with new formats, with smaller stores, not just the sprawling supercenters, but, you know, smaller stores that they can sort of put up in different communities. And so this is an ongoing puzzle that retailers are trying to solve. What kind of store do they put in a rural community that might be dominated by dollar stores in a way that allows them to be viable, but still serve the community's needs in a way that the Dollar General perhaps isn't?
And I wonder too about, I mean, the other thing we've seen, you know, this explosive growth of Amazon, so many people ordering online over the past year, that doesn't strike me as something dollar stores offer. I mean, I guess I've never seen that. How do you think they're going to fare against online retailers?
You know, they do have websites, but for the most part, their bread and butter is people stopping in. You know, they are there are a lot of dollar stores in many communities, and so they're the closest place you can go if you need something at the end of the day. And that's traditionally how they've been used. I mean, that's how a lot of analysts see dollar stores, is that they're just a place where you would stop in midweek if you needed to pick up a carton of milk, or maybe ran out of, you know, kitchen sponges or something like that. They weren't meant to be the site of your weekly grocery shopping. And so, sorry, I totally lost my train of thought. But that's the dynamic that we're seeing.
Yeah, I know I've taken advantage of them when, you know, they tend to have later hours and you're just like, I really need something. I just got to run over and grab something. I'm wondering, though, you mentioned that they have kind of a reputation of thinly staffing their stores. And I mean, I can testify to that oftentimes you go to the store and it can be a little chaotic. You know, you got just boxes everywhere, things kind of strewn about. Is that a strategy that they employ? Is that intentional, or is that maybe just vary from location to location?
You know, I don't think it's intentional, but I think it's just the cost of doing business, so to speak. You know, their priority is keeping prices low, and that's why people go there. And so I think if you're shopping at the dollar store, you're willing to overlook things like messy aisles and maybe, you know, short-staffed stores. You're there for the low prices, and that's what they deliver on.
Yeah. And I've seen reporting that safety concerns have also been an issue because of some of the locations, some of the hours, some of the thin staffing that you've mentioned, where there can be violence in the parking lot, and there's not necessarily the staff there to handle it. Is that something that you've seen in your reporting?
Yes, that's been a growing problem for the dollar store industry across the board. You know, like I said, these stores are very thinly staffed. They don't have big investments in security and surveillance cameras, things like that. And so they become easy targets for crime. And that's something that's gotten worse during the pandemic in many parts of the country, as people sort of face more dire situations.
We're talking about the rise of dollar stores this morning. You can join the conversation here, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Abba Badarai. She's the national retail reporter for The Washington Post. And let's go to the phones now. We have Tony joining us from Egg Harbor this morning. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I live in Door County, and Sister Bay has already voted down proposal for one, and then Egg Harbor just recently voted down the same proposal. I think the crux of it is that the dollar store is a cheap form of instant gratification that you could walk in there, probably leave with something you didn't intend on buying. It doesn't take a lot of effort, and I think it's really a greater communication to really what's going on in the country, that there's this big separation between the rich and the poor, and I think it's an opportunity for the poorer to get instant gratification without a lot of investment. And I think it speaks to really the economic division of wealth in this country.
So, Tony, was it controversial when your town was going through that decision? Were there people that were like, hey, I need this?
There were more dollar signs with red circles through them along the road than there were, we need a dollar store. So, and I think Door County is a perfect example of a community that thrives on tourism. And I just don't think they liked diminishing the brand by having a bargain basement store. And I'm not proud of it. I guess I'm a little embarrassed about it, but I understand it. So I think there's the right place for everything. But I think the broader topic is the division of wealth in this country.
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Abba, what do you think about that? What do you think about it? Tony raises these really interesting issues about the kind of stereotypes at play in communities.
Absolutely. And I think he's completely on point with his broader point that this speaks to economic inequality in this country, which we know is worsening in just about every way. And this is a symptom of that. And in some ways, it's also a driver of that. You know, as more dollar stores move in and choke out other businesses in a community, that ends up being the only option. And so it's just this cycle that these stores sometimes end up perpetuating.
We got another call from Brian in Eau Claire, who said he's also against dollar stores. He's affiliated with a small town grocer and feels like dollar stores don't really add to the local town economy. And we've got another call coming in. We've got Nancy in Grafton that wants to join the conversation. Good morning, Nancy.
Well, good morning. The sun is shining over here.
Oh, good. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, there's a difference between Dollar General, Dollar Tree, and I'll tell you, Dollar Tree, everything is a dollar. They don't have anything that's more than a dollar. And but the thing is, you know, if you're working there, you start out at minimum wage, like $7, and was it 25 or 35 cents an hour? You unload trucks, you stock shelves, you clean the floors, you run the cash registers, you do all those things for that minimum wage, and that's because it's a Dollar Tree. Now, I don't know about the Dollar Generals, because we have two, actually. We have two Dollar Tree stores in our community here. So
such a good point, Nancy. You're hustling when you work there. You're working hard for little pay, and that's in service of getting people these low prices. Abba, what effect do these stores have on wages and the job market?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, typically they do pay minimum wage, like Nancy said, which is lower than many of their competitors. Amazon, Best Buy, Target, Walmart have all moved to higher wages of $11 an hour or $15 an hour. And so these are significantly lower wages that many dollar stores are paying. And that sort of it ends up creating the cycle of rapid turnover. Many of the dollar store's employees I've spoken to, you know, are unhappy. They say they're very short-staffed, they're overworked. It is a paycheck, but they're not looking to stay there short-term. So that sort of adds to the overall instability of the stores, I think.
Yeah. We had another comment come in about the economy surviving off of folks on really, really low income and fixed income communities. Is that a key factor that they use in citing their locations, the average wages of the population in the area?
You know, that's not something they publicly cite, but I think it's absolutely a part of their calculation. And we see that, you know, people on a fixed income are struggling more than ever. Prices have gone up 5% in the last year. And that's even more pronounced for certain items that are essential, you know, food, gasoline, things like that are getting more expensive, which means people on a fixed income are struggling in particular.
Well, Abba Batarai, national retail reporter with The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, the author of a new book shares the true story of a Wisconsin woman who tried to resist the Nazi regime and was executed for it. We learn about her influence on society and how Wisconsin shaped her. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.